I love to sit and hear him dream. He tells it like a story. He talks about a better time, happy days and glory. No more scratching for a living, like a chicken pecking. He's got the whole world figured out, and even more. I reckon the moon don't rise to light the sky. The moon comes up just shine on pearly, pearly.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, July 31st, 2011. My name is James Vincent Marino, and on the call this morning, we have Peter Joseph Felicia and Go Go to Disco. No, we have also Michael Anthony Portantier. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com. Also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesday and for the New York Star Ledger and for many other places and times. Peter, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, and you're back from two trips, one abroad and one to Pennsylvania, which is almost like abroad. So also with us is Michael Anthony Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. He can be found at BroadwayStars.com, where you can see his writing and photography. We'll wait for the police to go by.
Mm-hmm. It's usually me. That's usually Ninth Avenue, but it's not today.
It's not? Michael, his writing and photography can be found at followspotphoto.com, also at broadwaystars.com. He also writes for npr.org. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
The listeners are probably wondering why I'm introducing everybody with three names, because we have two other guests here who also have three names. We have Jennifer Ashley Tepper and Kevin Michael Murphy. They are producing a show called If It Only Even Runs a Minute. Did I get that correct, Jennifer?
Yes.
You got it.
If It Only Even Runs a Minute. If It Only Even Runs a Minute. All righty. Jennifer, good morning. Welcome.
Thanks. We're happy to be here and happy to be using three names.
And also Kevin Michael Murphy is with us. Kevin, say hello to everybody.
Hey, all.
All right. So you guys have a show called If It Only Even Runs a Minute. I will get that eventually by the end of the podcast. But tell me, Jennifer, tell me about the show and tell me the genesis of it.
Sure. So basically, of course, it's the lyric from the song It's a Hit from Merrily We Roll Along. And I just said, of course, because everyone here knows that. And, you know, everyone on the street should know that as well, of course. But we started... Yes, go ahead. What was that?
Oh, no, I just said that they should know that, Jen. You're right. Yeah.
Oh. Quick one. So we started doing these concerts. The first one we did was in January of 2010. And basically we wanted to do, you know, we all love underappreciated musicals and underappreciated songs from them. And we got really excited about the idea of possibly doing an evening that featured, a lot of those, including some by original cast members. And then the thing that really hit it off was that I had access to a bunch of photo archives from research projects I was doing and started saving these quote unquote rare and inspiring Broadway photos. And once we kind of got the idea to juxtapose the photos with also the concert, we were very excited about that. So we did our first concert January 2010 at the Beachman. And since then, we've done them at Nymph and La Poisson Rouge, and now we're on number 7 at Caroline. So it's kind of crazy. It's been more than we thought it would be.
All right. Kevin, what's your involvement in this?
In this, I actually saw Jen's photos and I got so inspired by them. She would put them on Facebook and I would spend hours just looking at these photos and just getting so excited by them. And I think when we started doing the concerts, we thought it would be fun for us. And we're like, this is going to be really fun. And then when we got there in the room at the Beachman and these original cast members started telling stories, we realized that it was something bigger than what we thought it was, and it was just so inspiring and exciting, and it's something that we can't wait to do the next one. Whenever we finish the concert, we're like, okay, when's the next one's going to happen? How soon can we do it? And who can we get? And just coming up with all of the different shows. Like I said to Jen one day, and I was like, oh God, are we going to run out of shows soon? And then she then proceeds to send me a list of all the shows that we haven't even touched yet. And I'm like, oh, you're right. There's plenty of underappreciated musicals to go around.
Yeah, we had two moments in the first concert where we were like, oh, this is a thing. The first one was Craig Carnelia came and he spoke about Sweet Smell of Success in his life after high school. And he said something about, oh my God, I can't believe this room. If a bomb went off, you know, the future of musical theater would be dead kind of thing. It was very, like, very funny. But he was basically, him and Mama Allen also spoke and was just like, I can't believe all the young people that really care about musical theater history and about really honoring these shows. And it was both of them that I think that first night hit us, and we were like, oh, this is like a wonderful thing that we just want to do so much more of, and bringing together Broadway history and current Broadway people, and that kind of inspired us.
Well, one of the best things about the shows, and I think I've only missed one, is that you do include such a wide range of types of material. I remember, I mean, you know, you'll go see, there was one concert that had a number from Me and Juliet, you know, alongside, you know, some things from rock musicals and you know, I was thinking it's so interesting that a Broadway show, even if it only runs, let's say, a week or two, you know, if you add previews and stuff, it's likely that you'll have had thousands of people see it, you know, even though it's a huge flop. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, let's figure it out. I mean, even if a show runs for 1 week and previews for 2 weeks, that's probably like 20,000 people. So it's not, you know, so they're very cultish, you know, but it's still, it's not an insignificant number of people. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sure that you, you know, get all kinds of stories from all kinds of people saying, oh God, I saw that show and the night I went, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's really interesting.
I love that. That's my favorite. After, I think, the Nymph performance, we just had so many people that I was just like, I wish everybody could get up on stage and tell their story of seeing the show. We could stay here all night. Like, I would do that.
Well, that's, I think, one of the most wonderful things about theater is that it's ephemeral. And so you see something that, you know, this performance can only happen a few times. And I remember, like, being in the audience of the musical In My Life, and I was like, I love this so much. Like, I'm experiencing the show right now and looking at the people next to me. And I was like, this is just absolutely amazing that this show exists and that, you know, for years to come, like, people may not even know that it exists, but it's going to pass down through stories.
So tell me, we have a lot of listeners to this podcast that are not in the New York City area, and as much as they try to get here, they get here for some of the really big shows and may miss your thing. Is there any talk about audio or video recordings of your shows and that others can see it?
Yeah, we're hopefully in the future, we're working on having a website that kind of organizes everything in one place. But for now, if you go to tinyurl.com/if-it-only-even-runs-a-minute-videos, you can find every video from our concert so far.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that. I didn't know you had everything up. That's fantastic.
Yeah, we have nearly everything up. And, you know, it's very, something that's been great to me is that we've never received anything but, oh, I'm so happy that my material is being presented kind of thing. Actually, that was so exciting with this time. We're doing Got to Go Disco, and Patrick Jude, who's the original leading man, is performing. And when we asked him to sing the song, he was like, oh, I would love to sing that, but I'm sorry to tell you that no recording exists and no sheet music exists. And, you know, I sent him the bootleg recording, and I was like, oh, actually, you know, us nerds have this, and our musical director is working on doing some sheet music, and I'll send it to you soon. And he was just kind of blown away that could happen and existed, and he hadn't heard himself sing it since 1979. And, you know, we've had a lot of, it was really wonderful. We've had a lot of, like, performers and writers have that experience where they're like, oh my God, I didn't know this existed. I didn't know anyone knew about this. And then we put them up on YouTube doing it.
We should mention that, yes, I mean, these concerts are a wonderful combination of actual people coming back to recreate their original performances, but also, you know, other people just, you know, more contemporary, younger performers singing songs from various shows. So, so for the one that's coming up, you have Matt Cavanaugh doing a what's billed as a cut showstopper from Urban Cowboy. I want to see what that is. Patrick Jude, who you mentioned, Perry Kroger, Senator Joe, and then you have people like Ann Harada, Jose Lana, Josh Grissetti, Randy Graff. The last one, I guess it was the last one that I went to, the one at Le Poisson Rouge, you had Jill Eikenberry singing from Onward, Victoria. I mean, it's not going to happen again, you know. it's just amazing.
Jennifer.
I always laugh at the Jill Eikenberry just because someone asked me to do them a favor once, and I was like, I will totally do that for you if you give me Jill Eikenberry's email address. It was such a, like, drug barter, so I could ask her to do Onward, Victoria. Before you can ask.
Jennifer, I was checking that tiny URL. It's tinyurl.com/what?
If it only even runs a minute videos.
Oh,
wow.
You know, that's kind of counterintuitive to tiny URL.
Yes.
You can also follow us on Twitter. We have a Twitter at runs a minute too. And we post a lot of videos on there, links to our videos too.
Okay. Let's see. When's the next one?
It'll be a couple months from now, but we're focusing on Monday at the moment because every single time we do the concert, we have 400 new ideas.
Well, I saw both Got to Go Disco and Senator Joe. The first time I saw Got to Go Disco, yes, I saw it twice. In a manner of speaking, I did. Friends of mine came up from Boston to see Sweeney Todd. That was the big thing at the time, of course. And they had tickets for a Tuesday night. So they came up on Saturday and they saw they're playing our song in the matinee. And I remember Mama at night. And Sunday afternoon, they saw Whoopi. And that leaves us with Monday night with nothing to do. So I said, you know, let's go by the Minskoff. Let's see what's going on there. This show has been postponed so many times. This Got to Go Disco. Maybe they're doing a dress rehearsal that night. So we could just walk in the theater after all. You know, so we go to the Minskoff. We go up the escalators. We walk in. And the first thing we hear is an actor from the stage yelling, "I'm sick of it!" So, and I still remember probably the ninth director on the show in the middle of the audience saying, "Justin, drop your attitude." Well, anyway, there was chaos going on. I'm telling you, just absolute chaos. Nothing was, they started, poor Irene Karras started a number, stopped. They start again, nothing. Anyway, we get very bored, so we decide to leave. So we go down the escalators. But the problem with the Minskoff, you may have noticed that when they close it up, they bring down those iron gates. You know, we can't get out. We got trapped in Got to Go Disco Land. Well, the thing is, though, that I had been on stage at the Minskoff when where they did the gypsy run-throughs to Timbuktu and the Prince of Grand Street, and I knew where the stage door was. However, to get to the stage door, to go downstairs, you had to go on the stage. And I said, you know, guys, there's so much chaos going on here. They're not even going to notice us. They're going to think that maybe we're connected with the show in some capacity or we're new people coming in. We walked right on the stage and walked across the stage and went out the stage door in the back. And nobody said a word to us. Not a word. We were as welcome or unwelcome as anybody else who was in the cast.
Oh, my God.
Oh, maybe, yeah. My poor friends were petrified.
Maybe that's where Hare got the idea.
Maybe that's it, right. Yeah, so that was that. Senator Joe was even more bizarre because I was just walking home one night, minding my own business. I live off 8th Avenue, and I happened to be on the side of the street where the Neil Simon Theater was as I was passing 52nd Street. And there was a whole bunch of people under the darkened marquee. Now, the marquee still said Kenny Loggins
on Broadway.
Yeah, Celebrate Me Home is a show named after, you know. But there are a whole bunch of people under there. And, I mean, even though the marquee is not lit, the fact is that there are so many people going into the theater. So I thought, well, I've got to see what this is. You know, so I walk over. over, and I just thought, well, this is probably an open dress rehearsal, so you know, I'll just walk up. But there was a ticket taker there, so I just walked past him, and he said, wait, where's your ticket? And I said, you need one? Like, it was the strangest thing in the world. I mean, like, of course you need a ticket, but anyway, you need one? Yeah, you need one. So I went to the box office, and I said, somebody left me a ticket, you know, and I gave my name. And I'm telling you, a guy pulled out a stack of tickets, you know, they had to be 6 inches long, and just pulled out one and gave it to me. He wasn't checking. He didn't care. So now, for the first time in my life, I am going to see a show, and I have no idea what I'm about to see. I mean, none. I know it's not Celebrate Me Home. I mean, that has come and gone. I mean, this is really quite an experience. But I think, well, the second I'm going to get a playbill, and I'll find out what I'm seeing. Well, ironically enough, the playbill was split diagonally on the cover. One on the left, it said Senator Joe, and on the right, it said Return of the Nimrod.
Oh, yeah.
So so this was going to be two musicals done in rep. So at least I've got it down to two, but I still don't know which show it's going to be. You know, so it was Senator Joe, and I will admit that in the scene where, which takes place in Joe McCarthy's stomach, and a woman named Fatty Acids, a character named Fatty Acids, was doing a big dance in Joe McCarthy's stomach. That's how she's building the playbill, Fatty Acids. I thought, you know, I'm not going to stay for this. I'm tired, you know. So I did leave after the first act, which, yeah, and whenever I leave after the first act, the day comes that I regret it. And the day has come now, yeah. You know. So I later met the man who played Senator Joe, who had Joe Daugherty, I think his name was, and a very checkered career. I was at a performance of Bye Bye Birdie in Philadelphia where he was singing Kids, and suddenly there was a power failure. And when I talked to him about that later, he said, you know, I really thought I had died in the middle of the number because everything went black. You know, he said, oh, my God, I just died on stage. I really actually died, you know, for a few seconds later, we were all going, hey, put on the lights, you know. So, so yes, indeed. You don't get any of this at the movies, no question about it. Another reason why going to a live show, you never know what's going to happen.
Yeah, true.
We actually have the original cast member who played Fatty Deposit, as well as the character of Mamie Eisenhower, is singing a song from Senator Joe in the concert.
It's actually Fatty Deposits, not Fatty Acids?
I believe it's Fatty Deposit, according to IMDb, but I would trust you.
No. Don't do that. That's your first mistake. No. As Robert Goulet sang in Happy Time, the memory plays tricks, eh? You know, so I'm sure, since you've been working with it recently, I'm sure Fatty Deposits. But do you believe we're having this discussion? I mean, right. Really, you know, on whether a character is named Fatty Deposits or Fatty Acids? I mean, God, like, what a world, I tell you. So, how funny.
So, Jennifer, I'm looking at your New York Musical Theater Festival 2011 page, or actually it's your 2010 page for when you did the show last year, and you had a cast of thousands. You know, as we get full swing into the festivals for Michael and Peter going to see thousands of shows, tell us from your perspective and putting on a show at the festivals, what was that like?
This is a little crazy for us because we were, you know, all the NIMF concerts are two in one night, so they gave us the option of doing the same concert twice, but we decided to do two in a row of different ones because of the nature of our concert and the storytelling and the off-the-cuff. We just felt like we should do two different ones, so of course we had double concert in one night, which was really crazy and very wonderful. And actually, it's so funny. It's literally, as we've been doing Merrily in this edition of the concert, all I can do is quote Opening Doors in terms of our series because, you know, it literally, we've experienced so many of the same, you know, secondhand pianos, and it just seems very close to home. But we had a very large cast, and the best part of it was that we were at ATA Czernuchin, so there's that little, like, ramp above the theater, and we had a ton of the performers in one concert wanted to watch the other and vice versa, so that was really nice. That's always nice.
Yes, and it's the home of Urinetown, so that was nice. The original home of Urinetown.
Oh, yeah.
What I find interesting is that Jennifer is associated now, the first woman ever, with the Best Plays series. So she's really running the gamut, working with Best Plays and not-so-best musicals. So I think that's pretty
Well, you know, another thing about...
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, at the risk of stating the obvious, a lot of shows fail for various reasons, and a lot of times it's not because of the score. So I'm sure that you frequently have situations where, like, for example, this Monday, August 1st, some of the shows you're doing include High Fidelity, Legs Diamond, Merrily We Roll Along, and Redhead. So I'm sure you have people after every show coming up and saying, that was terrific, why did that show flop? You know, and you know, sometimes the answer is, well, it was the book. Sometimes the answer is, well, the timing was wrong, or the you know, whatever. It could be 100 things, but many times it's not the score.
It kind of opens up this big discussion about, because we also have been doing underappreciated musicals that weren't technically the F-word flops, like Redhead and like Two Gentlemen of Verona, but that are somewhat underappreciated now. So it opens this conversation about, you know, all it takes is one decision by a producer or one casting aspect, and, you know, you've got a hit or not a hit, which is really interesting.
Well, the word one is very significant here because Ed Linderman, who did a show years ago called Broadway Jukebox, in which he would hand out a list of songs to the audience and would say, you pick the songs you want to hear tonight. And he would call on various people. And anyway, I talked to him once, and he said, you know, the story that fascinates me is the one about Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. And that is the fact that there it was, Dying Out of Town, until Jerome Robbins came in and said, you got to do a song that tells us we're going to have a comedy tonight. And Sondheim wrote that song. All right. I've talked to Sondheim. I have talked to Sondheim about this too, saying, come on. One song at the beginning made the difference. There were rewrites. He said, no, by that point in the show. I mean, yeah, the songs did go, Rise of Blue, you know, the Echo song, all this stuff. Yeah, we did do work on the show, but I'm telling you, when Comedy Tonight went in, everything else was exactly the same as you now know it, and it really made all the difference in the world. So Ed Linderman said, and I think this is so smart, he said, how many other shows were just one song away? Mm. You know, if they had had one different song, if it did it for Funny Thing, why couldn't it do it for other shows? Of course, Lord knows that plenty of shows were beyond repair with 7 new songs. But nevertheless, one has to wonder how many of these so-called, as you say, Jennifer, the F-word flops would have not been if there were one other song. Who knows? You know, but it's a very, very good point. I always felt Dance of the Vampires needed a Comedy Tonight song because the point is the logo looked serious. Michael Crawford from Phantom looked like it was going to be a serious show. And then, you know, it was such a show that was so stupid and wanted to be stupid. But the point is we thought that it was being serious and it didn't know that it was being stupid. If they had had a Comedy Tonight song, I think they would have been in better shape because we had been led to believe it was going to be a serious show. And frankly, it was supposed to be a serious show because the producers had opened. Well, suddenly everybody said, oh, people want musical comedy now. Let's go from a serious show to a funny show. But they didn't set it up right. Mm. So it might have made a difference if people knew it was really going to be a spoof. And not assuming it was going to be a serious vampire show. But the one show away, a song away theory is a very fascinating one to me. And it's one that I've held since Ed Linderman said that to me in 1990. I've never forgot it.
So, Peter, you're saying that Frank Wildhorn is 5 songs away from being Andrew Lloyd Webber?
Well, who knows? What I'm saying is the possibility exists. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that every show would have indeed succeeded with one different song, but it is tantalizing to think of the possibilities of that. That's all.
Well, yeah. Especially if we're talking about an opening number. I mean, one can understand why that would make a tremendous. But then also, yes, sometimes some shows have had. You know, like a tremendous 11 o'clock number that has basically, you know, boosted the whole show. And I know recently something sort of like that we sort of saw happen with Women on the Verge, where they moved, they were moving songs around at the last moment in a desperate attempt to make that work. And it didn't, but I think it's a similar kind of a thing. Specifically the song Madrid Is My Mama, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are so many elements of a musical and tiny things that seem tiny, like timing and the placement of a line or the existence of a minor character or not, you know, can make a tremendous difference.
We also have this big thing that's kind of similar where we always ask ourselves, how would musical theater history have been different without this? We did Rachel Lilly Rosenblum and Don't You Ever Forget It. And doing that was kind of mind-blowing because of, you know, people coming together for that show who ended up doing a chorus line who maybe circumstances wouldn't have transpired how they did without Rachel Lilly Rosenblum. And we've always had that with, you know, we do Flora the Red Menace, and then what if Kinder and Ebb had never worked on this together and come together for it? So there's a certain aspect of, like, it's all part of one thread of history, which is kind of magical to me. And it all exists in that world where everyone affects each other. Every show can lead to another show that might be a huge life-changing hit. And you never know. It's all kind of equal ground.
I think if we all live long enough, I really believe we're going to see Rachel Lilly Rosenblum again. Because
starring Leslie Kristner.
The thing is, I really do believe in a strange way it was ahead of its time, because now we have a lot of stupid musicals, and this was the first real out-and-out stupid musical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the thing is, we're used to those now, and there are so many people who go to musicals just to mock them. And, you know, like the Silence musical, things like that, where the So Bad It's Good musical. So I think that really Rachel Lilly Rosenblum would fare much better today. It's sad in a way to say that it was ahead of its time, because it doesn't speak well of the times we have today. But nevertheless, I have a feeling it will show up again, and I'll be there to see it.
All right. So let's wrap up here. How do we get tickets to go see your shows?
You can go to carolines.com, and then, you know, Monday night, August 1st, which is tomorrow, 7 p.m., and that'll lead you to it. We also always have a Facebook event if you search for If It Only Even Runs a Minute. And if you forget the words, just turn on It's a Hit on your Merrily cast recording. It's really just a trick to get people to listen to Merrily is all it is.
All right, and Jennifer, is it true that you woke up last night thinking you're going to be late to the State Thespian Festival?
That's absolutely true. I've been having this, you know, the concert is so important to us. It literally fries my brain where I just start thinking about nothing but all of these musicals. I had a middle of the night, and I've woken up in the middle of the night being like, oh my God, Anne Harada isn't going to, you know, what about, it's, you know, anything. It's just that the ultimate nightmare of, like, oh, I'm at high school and I don't have my books, but instead it's like, oh, I'm at the theater and I don't have my Williams Inn sheet music.
I know, Kevin, I know you sometimes perform in the shows. Are you performing this one? And if so, what?
I am not performing this one, but it's always been such a cool thing for me to be on both sides of it, just to get to sing some of my favorite songs from underappreciated musicals and share in that, and also just picking, like, one of my favorite parts is picking up, finding a song and being like, you know what, this person, they may not have any Broadway credits, they may not be known to everyone else, but we, Jen and I, know that this person is amazing, and seeing that person really flourish on this amazing song that no one's ever heard before. And now they sort of go down, if you search on YouTube, they're the only ones on YouTube singing this song, which I think is really awesome.
You bet.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
All righty. Well, Kevin and Jennifer, thank you for visiting with us this morning. We really appreciate it. And, you know, keep coming back as you have more shows.
Thank you so much for having us.
All right. Good day. I'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All righty. So back to our regularly scheduled program. Peter, you got up to Canada to the Shaw Festival. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experiences there? How long were you there?
Just 2 days. The motivation for the trip was to see My Fair Lady, which I had seen 50 years ago this week. So I wanted to commemorate that by going up to see it. Very nice production, and had a wonderful time, certainly reliving the experience. The people in it were fine, but I expect that not from the Shaw Festival. This was my third trip up there on Niagara-on-the-Lake, just a little bit past the Canadian border, not hard to find, charming little town, huge shops all around, three different theaters. The festival is now, coincidentally, 50 years old, just like my theater-going experience. And while they started with one, they went to two, and now they have three. And they do in rep do them in rep from April to almost November, and it's really quite a lineup they have there. I wound up seeing The President, which is actually a rewrite, a new adaptation of a Frank Molnar play. He's most famous for giving us Lilium, which gave us Carousel, and it was later made into the movie 1-2-3 by Billy Wilder. So it is about a man who's been entrusted with taking care of a very important client's grown daughter, and but he hasn't been paying as much attention as he should, and she winds up marrying a communist, which in those days was a pretty bad thing. So it's a farce, but what's so interesting in farces is that so many times you have people who are victims, who are put in circumstances, and then they try to lie their way out of it, and you always hear, you know, as they try to come up with the right lie and all this. What's better about this farce is this man will not be a victim. All right, the guy's a communist, fine. We will turn him into a fully upstanding citizen. In 1-2-3, it's an American. Here, it's another European country. But it is so wonderful to see this frenetic one-hour, one-act play where this man will just turn this guy into taking off his beard, giving him a new name, giving him a title, working all this out, signing papers, running around, doing a million things so this guy can be presentable and a real catch for when the girl's parents arrive, that they will be thrilled that she married this nobleman. And what's also of great interest is the fact that while the communist man disagrees with it at the beginning and only does it out of love for his new wife, the fact remains that little by little, you know, capitalism isn't so bad. It hits the spot. You know, there are a lot of pleasures to be had that he had denied himself. And so no question, Molnar is a little Ayn Randish there about talking about the system, that while capitalism may not be a perfect system, it certainly has its assets and beats communism every time. So that was really a treat to see, especially an actor named Lorne Kennedy in the lead role. Now, what's never happens at the Shaw Festival is that you see a man build over the title. But they did this show 3 years ago, and it was such a success that they brought it back this year, and they actually put him over the title. And I mean, this is a repertory company. This never happens. But when you see this man for an hour making decisions, running around, doing this, all right, here's what we got to do. Where's my secretaries? Come in. You got to do this. All right, call this man. Call this one. Yeah, it's like that Federal Express ad, you know, where the guy talks a mile a minute. I mean, it's like that. So that was really something. Then I saw Drama at Inish, which turned out to be a play I had seen at the Mint 2 years ago under a different title called Is Life Worth Living? Some of you may remember it under that title. But Drama at Inish is a story of a little seaside town in Ireland. Well, I guess you know that because we've certainly run across the word Inish in Martin McDonagh's plays. And it's a sleepy little town, and it's 1930, and there isn't much in the option of entertainment except the local theater down the street, which everybody goes to because, you know, no TV yet, radio reception isn't good. I mean, this is it. This is the only game in town. Well, this year, the two people who come to run the repertory theater want to uplift the town. And what they're going to do is do Chekhov, and they're going to do serious plays. And what happens is they're going to do A Doll's House by Ibsen. So what happens in the town is the people go to these plays, and they're influenced by them. I mean, people who see A Doll's House, well, suddenly marriages are breaking up. So it's really interesting to see how art affects people. It is not just a night out on the town. It really is something that stays with you and affects your life. Now, the implication, of course, when marriages are breaking up and people are actually doing suicide attempts because life isn't worth living to them after they see these door plays by Chekhov, well, you know, the question becomes, really, are people better off not seeing these plays? However, these people do wake up and find out who they really are, and their lives do get better as a result of these plays. Oh, you know, they suffer. This is a no pain, no gain type of situation. They suffer, but they do wind up to be better people and more self-actualized people as a result of seeing these plays. So art may be dangerous, but ultimately it's nurturing, and it changes you for the better.
Peter, maybe they should just do a lot of productions of How to Succeed in Business.
That's a good idea, too. Yes, indeed. That will certainly help immeasurably. That's three. What else did I see there?
Did you see the when the rain stops falling?
I didn't. No. Well, really, the motivation for the trip was the fair lady. It really was. And as a result, it was... there were so many other things I wanted to see. I wanted to see the Admirable Crichton because you never get a chance to see that. But what I did see was a new musical called Maria Severa. And Maria Severa is a story that takes place in Lisbon. It's not unlike Evita in many ways, and that may ultimately hurt it, about this poor girl who falls in love with a powerful man. In this case, he's a bullfighter. And they're much more explicit than Evita ever is. And again, maybe I shouldn't cast aspersions on Eva Peron, but this lady is an out and out on the street prostitute. And the bullfighter comes down just for kicks, you know, with his brother. But it leads to a more fulfilling relationship than either one of them expected. But of course, you know, the bullfighter's mother is aghast because while they are a titled family, they are a poor family, and he has to marry well, and he's their great white hope in marrying because, after all, now that he's achieved fame as a bullfighter, which will not last forever, she feels he's got to strike while the iron is hot, and she's got the perfect girl picked out for him. So it's that type of story, and it is a little too familiar. The music, I thought, was quite good in a Spanish, Portuguese, flamenco-y type of way. It's unlike scores that I've heard, and it fell very nicely on the air. So I don't know if we'll have a future for Maria Severa, but I did like it quite a bit. So that was the fourth show I saw.
On the Shaw website, Maria Severa is, they give the story in Portuguese. Did they do some Portuguese within the production itself?
I don't believe so. I don't recall any, even a word of Portuguese. There may have been some that I'm forgetting, but it did seem to me it was totally in English. Even when, you know, she occasionally would sing a song. Part of her appeal is that she has a wonderful voice, and that's one of the things that makes the bullfighter intoxicated with her, that she really sings beautifully and she writes her own songs. But all those were done in English. So there were some diegetic songs where she got up there and simply performed as a performer. And definitely worth seeing. You know, it's a long drive, 7 hours. And you got to, you know, wait about a half hour to get into Canada and even longer to get back. From New York, it is quite a trek. But as I say, this is my third trip there, so the acting is stellar. The productions are beautifully designed, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. And at least once in your life, try to get up to Niagara on the lake. And you also get to see Niagara Falls. Why not?
I only went one summer, and yes, it's just a beautiful the town, the village, whatever word
sure.
is beautiful in itself. The falls are right there. Mm-hmm. Basically, and the venues, the three venues for the shows are all lovely in their own way, and it's definitely worth a trip.
It's funny, when you said venues, I really thought you were going to say vineyards, because for wine lovers, no, it's a good place to go for wine lovers, too. There are plenty of wine tasting opportunities and vineyards. They're very proud of that up there. And so that's another asset that should be added to the list of going up to Niagara-on-the-Lake.
Well, it sounds like a great summer getaway that we should plan on for next year.
Mm-hmm.
All righty. You also headed out to Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival. Tell us about that.
Well, while I've seen all of Shakespeare's plays, my girlfriend Linda hasn't, so she pays attention. And when she finds out there's one that isn't being done, she wants to go. And this was The Two Noble Kinsmen, which who knows how much Shakespeare wrote. There is some talk that John Fletcher was really the power behind it, and Shakespeare came in and did a little play doctoring. Who knows what happened? Anyway, but I'll tell you this much. If you go to the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival, it says The Two Noble Kinsmen by William Shakespeare. I think John Fletcher has to call his agent and get that straightened out. You know, the playbill does say both their names, but the poster out front simply says William Shakespeare. Well, here's what they decide to do. They decided to do it in the way that Shakespeare did his plays in staging, in the sense that there was no director, no director at all, because they found out that in Shakespeare's day, actors came to the production already with the parts learned, and then they just did what they did. Yeah, and whatever they felt like doing, that was that. So they said, you know, let's try this. You know, this should be a noble experiment for the noble kinsman. So while next door was Hamlet, which was terrific, a very good Hamlet, the 3 hours really sped by, and that was done conventionally with the theater's artistic director, Patrick Mulcahy, directing and directing beautifully, a wonderful production, one of the best Hamlets I've seen. Next door, it was more of a ragtag situation, and I wonder if I would have noticed that there was no director if they had put down, you know, like directed by George Spelvin, you know, that type of thing, Walter Plinge, which is George Spelvin in England. If indeed I would have said, wait, there's no unity here, you know, she's doing this thing and he's in a completely different play. There was a little of that, but again, it may have just happened that because of the power suggestion, they had told me in advance there'd be no director. You know, I think they make a very good case for the play. I think it's a very entertaining play. My girlfriend was reasonably appalled by it because she had read it, she had listened to it on CDs, and she thought of it as a serious play, and they played it for laughs. But I thought the comedy was well-intentioned, and I thought it made sense. It's about two guys who are the best of friends. They are cousins, but they're the best of friends, and they love each other dearly. Oh, they die for each other until they see this same girl. Oh, wow. Amelia, oh, she has the music that makes them dance. And as a result, you know, that leads them into trouble. It's very much a riff on A Midsummer Night's Dream. There's even Theseus and Hippolyta, the same Theseus and Hippolyta from Midsummer Night's Dream in this one. So that's very interesting as well. And it ends with not Puck coming out, of course, because there's no Puck, but a speech very, very much like that, if we have offended, you know. So really, this was almost a strange type of sequel to A Midsummer Night's Dream, indicating, Lord, what fools these mortals be. So it was fascinating to see the comparison between this and Midsummer Night's Dream. So we all know the sequels can be good or bad. I mean, there's been The Godfather 2 and there's been Annie 2, you know, so it can be either one, but and I guess this one falls somewhere in between. But you know, for a group of actors getting together and doing it themselves, I had quite a wonderful time. So again, purists may not be as enthralled, but really, when do you get a chance to see the two noble kinsmen? By the way, Patrick Mulcahy told me after Hamlet that he plans to do them all. This is a goal of that theater. They've done about 20, two dozen so far, so they still have about a dozen to go. So, Pennsylvania Shakespeare, about 2 hours away, less than that really, is worth keeping an eye on if you're the type of person who likes to check off all the Shakespeares that you want to see. I don't think they've announced their season next year, but it's worth keeping an eye on. You might get to see Henry IV Part II, which is rarely done, or any of the others that don't show up with regularity.
Speaking of Shakespeare, I got to see much less of a rarity, King Lear, at the RSC, the RSC production at the Park Avenue Armory, and I was very happy to get in because it's the run is very, very sold out. I wanted to see it, if nothing else, because of the recreation of basically of their home theater inside the Armory, which
isn't it pretty.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Which show did you see, Peter?
I did, and I just went to the press party where they showed us the theater.
Oh, right. Yeah. I had gone to the original press conference like 2 years ago when they announced this was happening, and I was really glad to get to see it, and it was quite a wonderful production of King Lear with a very, very excellent performance by Greg Hicks in the title role. And the thing about him is that he made the decision to be a much more vital King Lear than we sometimes see. Although that, I think, guess that interpretation has been more popular in recent years with people like Ian McKellen and maybe Kevin Kline. But it really works. And the cast was just really excellent overall. fascinating to me is that The Fool was played by a woman, Sophie Russell. And it never occurred to me. I actually had played The Fool in a production years ago. It worked beautifully. She sort of, I don't know if she was supposed to actually be a woman, or she almost came across as a sort of like a teenage boy. But whatever she was, it was, she really was fantastic in the part. And it was, I'm very glad I got to see it. It's such an amazing undertaking. It's a co-presentation of the RSC, the Lincoln Center Festival, and the Armory itself, in association with Ohio State University. So you have all of those organizations coming together to do this really once-in-a-lifetime thing at the Armory there.
Peter, we get back to Pennsylvania Shakes for a second. It's right outside of Allentown, New York, just to give people bearing, because Pennsylvania is a very large state. I guess, as you mentioned, about a two-hour drive out of New York. And the fact that they all came in and was sort of a self-directed show, Michael, maybe you could help us out here with this. I very often conceive in my own head that opera is sometimes like that, because people know the repertoire and get booked in for, you know, for a show and come in and do this. You know, what's your take on that, Michael, in comparison to opera?
The short answer to that is that apparently it used to be very much like that. People would come in with their own interpretations and do it what they did. Sometimes they would even come in their old in their own costumes. Years ago, much less
Tito and Lenny a tenor. You know,
much less nowadays. In fact, some people think it's gone a little too far in the other direction, and it's now too much of a director's medium with all of these, iron-handed directors, slapping on these very, very rigid concepts. But you do still occasionally get it's funny. You will get a diva like Angela Georgiou, who will come in, and say, "Oh, I'm not doing that. I'm doing it my way." But that's a little much rarer. There are a few, very few, singers with that kind of a power and name nowadays who are going to risk doing something like that. But it is an interesting point. Years ago, it was very much not a director's medium. And then people like Tyrone Guthrie and Franco Zeffirelli started to get involved. And then they really elevated the art form. But then, as I say now, maybe it's gone a little bit too much in the other direction.
Many years ago, I was a personal assistant for a quote-unquote star. Somebody who you and I would think is a star. They're very big, and they came into a theater to do a 1 week, basically a 1 week production, basically a put in. And everybody in the cast had rehearsed for weeks before the star arrived, and the star arrived, and had a couple days of rehearsal, and then went in and did the thing. And the director kept on giving this star the same note over and over. And I was at lunch one day with the star, and I said, "What's the deal with this? Can I help you here?" He said, "No." He says, "I just disagree with them, And when I'm not doing it, and when I'm out on stage, I just do what I want to do, and that's the great thing about theater versus film and television. They can't make you do something in theater." And he would get that note every single night. The stage manager or the director would come up and after the show and give a note, or right before the next performance or right after what had happened. And he would say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I forgot about that. I'll tomorrow night I'll work on it." Yeah, exactly. And theater is the actor's medium. You know, you can't. can't get away with that.
That's really interesting. I mean, I often wonder about that. I've had some of my own experience with that as both an actor and director in community theater, which is not exactly the same thing, but in a way it is. And yeah, you know, I mean, it's, I wonder if the actor tried it the way it was suggested. That's my only thing. There's a famous story, you know, I mean, because sometimes people, you know, sometimes, especially when it comes to comedy, you know, sometimes there's only one right way to do something. You know, there's a way that's going to get a laugh, or you know, there are maybe two or three ways that are going to get a laugh, but then there are 10 other ways that aren't. And that is very personal to a certain extent, the way the actor relates to the audience and what he does to get a laugh. But there's the famous story of Barbara Streisand, who even apparently at the very start of her career thought she knew more than anyone else about anything. And she was doing the Miss Marmalstein number in I Can Get It For You Wholesale. And the way she was doing the last line, which is "I could bust," she was doing it in a way that it was not, not only was it not getting a laugh, but people didn't know the number was over. It was a total, you know, people loved the number itself all the way through, but then she ended it in a way that did not work. And I'm sorry, I'm telling the story somewhat backwards. Let me just quickly correct myself. She was doing it the way she was directed, and then she insisted that she wanted to do it this other way. And Lehman Engel, I believe, told her, do not do that because it won't work because blah 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 blah. And she insisted, she insisted, she insisted, and she did it one night and crickets. So, you know, it's, you know, I don't know. It's a collaborative medium is the main thing about theater. And you just have to listen to people who maybe have more experience than you and maybe know what's going to work and what isn't.
That's just crazy talk. Collaborative.
Sorry.
Michael, I saw a woman play the fool in King Lear a few years ago, and it was one of Roseanne's daughters from her TV show. Alicia Goranson did it in Princeton some years ago. She was fine, but one doesn't necessarily think of one of Roseanne's daughters being in a Shakespearean production, but yes, indeed, she was.
Well, another thing that struck me about this production was, it always strikes me about King Lear, if you have good actresses as Goneril and Regan, they can really walk away with the show, practically. I mean, and that's saying something in King Lear.
Yeah, it's true.
The characters, they're so well written. I mean, just the way that they go from, you know, that they become more and more.
Yeah,
it's fantastic, really. Mm-hmm.
Hey,
well, we'll get to see another one later this year.
Very soon, right? Quite soon, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because Sam Waterston is doing it.
Did you guys hear that Mark Rylance gave his Tony Award away?
Yep.
Yes.
It seems that he gave his Tony Award for his portrayal of the character in Jerusalem to the man who inspired it. I wonder if there's any others out. You think Patti LuPone gave her Evita to
We do know
the family
that after Dame Edna won her award, the following year she came on to present, and she said, "In last year I got a Tony Award, and I still have it." So we know she kept hers. You know, it was a great line.
I know that this isn't exactly the same thing, but I know that Shelley Winters gave her Oscar for the Diary.
Diary
of Anne Frank to the Anne Frank House, I guess, the foundation.
Right. Yeah, I saw it while I was there. Yeah,
I always thought that was a wonderful thing to do.
You bet.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Patti LuPone and Evita possibly giving away her Tony Award, which I'm 99.9% sure she didn't.
Yes.
But there was a little rumor this week that Mandy and Patti are headed for Broadway in an evening with Patti LuPone and Mandy Patinkin. Now, which lawyers?
Yeah.
Talking about names of the title.
Really.
Alphabetical? I guess it's alphabetical.
Well, they've been, as you may know, they've been doing that concert for several years in very everywhere but in New York, I guess. But my favorite quote was somebody said that somebody, whoever the set designer is, better make sure that the scenery is edible.
Oh, and so Patty and Mandy are coming back, so I guess neither one of them will be in Funny Girl.
Yeah, I guess not.
And Funny Girl's headed to Broadway without Leah Michele, says Roger Friedman of Showbiz 411. Michael, did we ever think that this was a real possibility?
I thought it was a possibility. I thought it was a very good possibility. But also, I mean, I guess we don't want to get into it, but there's been this real unpleasantness this week with you know, Ryan Murphy, who created Glee.
Why are you guessing we don't want to get into it? Get into it.
Well, I mean, all right. We'll just give the basics. He had said that Leah Michele and two of the others, Corey Monteith, and I'm not sure who the third one was, would not be coming back to the show because their characters are going to be graduating, period. So then there was this huge uproar among Gleeks and just discussion about that and, you know, how unfortunate and blah, 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 and keep them on anyway and blah, blah, blah. And then the actors got involved in it to some extent. And then Ryan Murphy threw some kind of a hissy fit and said, well, what they didn't say was, you know, that we were all in discussion about having a spinoff series in which they were going to star as graduates, you know. But he was like, well, you know, if you didn't say that and if all you said was that they were graduating and they weren't going to be on it anymore, people are going to assume no more than that. I mean, there might have been a way for you to say something you know, without giving away that there, that you were planning a spinoff to make it sound less final. But anyway, I thought that my point is that when I first read that they weren't coming back, I thought that maybe that was a signal that Leah Michele would in fact be doing Funny Girl, but I guess not.
All righty. Did you guys see this? Was it Patrick Healy wrote the story on the flops?
Yeah. Yeah, about how when they go to London, they're not just replications, that they do work on them. And that's a very good thing. Yeah, I was in London last year and Legally Blonde was playing there, and I wasn't the least bit enticed to go see it because I just assumed it was going to be Legally Blonde as usual. Nothing against Legally Blonde, it's just I played that room, and as a result, you know, when I go to London, I like to see things I haven't seen. But this article really piqued my interest that if indeed they're doing work on these shows and they're not the rubber stamp replications, you know, if I go to London anytime soon, I think I will drop in on Legally Blonde and certainly Shrek to see what the differences are.
I could certainly understand that. The point was made that someone said that maybe one of the reasons that Legally Blonde is going over better over there is simply because the theater is so much smaller. And I could certainly see that. I kind of felt it was like a little too pumped up at the Palace. And I could see that with no other changes being made, that just having it in a smaller theater would make a huge difference for the better.
I suppose it would, because at heart, it's a very sweet story.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Does it have that one song?
Ha ha. Gotcha. Apparently so. Legally Blonde has been successful, and I suspect we're going to see it in high schools quite a bit. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely going to happen. I think parents of children today have many a Legally Blonde in their future.
And in the case of Tarzan, apparently they're really, really rewriting and reworking it. So that's a different, I mean, that's a whole different situation. It's not
Tarzan's tough, you know, because if you're not a major theater with a major budget, it's going to be hard to swing. You know, no, I'm serious. I mean, you're not going to play high schools and community theaters and everything safely. I'm sure somebody will do it.
I know the reason.
Players out there.
I know the reason Michael was laughing is because of the word swing. Did you mean that as a pun? Or
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Good.
You were so guileless in the way you said it
that
I thought it was possible that, that you might not have even realized what you said. But good for you. Good. You faked me out. I'm impressed.
Hey, speaking of being impressed, you both of you last week had talked about your deep dark sources of the Tony Awards not being at Radio City for the next 5 years, and lo and behold, the day after you guys talked about it, it was officially announced. Are the Tony Awards committee afraid of you? You know,
that must be it. Yeah, yeah, petrified.
Well, I think it was one of those weird things, James, where it was public knowledge, but it just hadn't been, broadcast. Yeah.
It
was public knowledge, but the public didn't know it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is it wasn't.
Oh, I wasn't mocking you, honestly. It really is. It's that much of a paradox. You know, it was public knowledge, but the public didn't know it. It really was.
I mean, I did originally find out like 2 years ago or whatever, when a friend of mine who's someone I know who works at Radio City told me. But then subsequently, I had heard or read it from various sources. But I guess it didn't become official till now. But the other part of that equation is that I'm not sure how well this show is doing, Zarkana. Do we know for a fact that they mean that they would be doing Zarkana for 5 years, or would just they be doing some Cirque du Soleil?
Well, all I heard was that the Tony Awards have been blocked out of that time frame from Radio City Music Hall for the next 5 years. They've not said that Zarkana is going to be the result. And as far as I know, there's no published box office numbers for how Zarkana is doing or any Radio City shows. But if any indication of discounts via email and websites and Twitter and Facebook and other advertising means, there's a lot of discounts going on for Zarkana pretty early in their run. So,
and on that note, did you read? This was very interesting to me. There's always so many sources for problems. Apparently, a lot of tickets to Zarkana are being sold at the TKTS booth. And the idea is the thought is that a lot of shows are suffering about that. Did we mention this last week?
No, I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Karen Joy David wrote a piece about this too, that it has to be pulling away people from Broadway.
And certain shows that seem to be really that like especially things like Priscilla, which is right across the street from the booth, so that might be something that people would at the last minute say, let's go see that. But now they're thinking, oh, hey, we can go to Radio City Music Hall,
I didn't even know TKTS sold Radio City Music
Hall
shows.
Neither did I, but now I know, now we both know, I guess.
So I guess in the beginning of this conversation of the Zarkana and the Tony Awards and everything, was I meant to mention that the official announcement that the 2012 Tony Awards is going to be at the Beacon, and we wanted to. And the rumor is that it's not been officially announced that I've seen anywhere that the next 5 years is going to be at the Beacon, but that's what the rumor is as well, is that people really enjoyed the Beacon, and that might be the new home for it. So
yeah,
that's interesting.
Indeed.
We should just mention, yesterday, we the theater lost Sam Norkin, who was a wonderful, theater caricaturist. And so that's one of several losses we've had lately. I am delighted to have read that they have established a new award in his name at the Drama Desk Awards. And I believe it's specifically targeted to go to an off-Broadway show or person. So that's wonderful news. And I that was announced a few days ago. I guess they must obviously have known that Mr. Norkin was in.
Yes, I agree. Sam was very important to me, and I was very honored when he asked me to write the foreword to his book, the collection of his drawings, about 20 years ago. So he was very important to me growing up in Boston, because the Boston Globe used to pick up his caricatures from the New York Daily News. I still remember the first one I ever saw for a play called Lorenzo, which was trying out in Boston. It lasted 4 performances. That was it in New York. But the point is, I still remember vividly looking at that drawing and being intoxicated by it. also, you know, the very famous story about the apple tree. The apple tree had a very ornate set for the first of the three musicals, was three one-act musicals for the Garden of Eden. And suddenly Mike Nichols was noticing that it was so ornate that he couldn't see where the actors were. So they threw it all out. And it was in the Schubert Alley. I didn't find out about it. Schubert in Boston, the alley there. If I had known about that, I certainly would have gone down to see what the set was like. So the best we can do is Sam Norkin's drawing, because he did the drawing of the apple tree before the set was thrown out, and so at least gives you a taste
of
what that show looked like before it became a very perfunctory ladders and just one stylistic representation of an apple tree. So but Sam's book is really worth having. It's a terrific collection, and it's a nice stroll down memory lane. Memory Boulevard, really, because there are so many wonderful drawings in it.
Hmm. All right. I'm going to link to Sam's book on Amazon in the show notes if anybody wants to jump over there and take a look at it, possibly purchase it. I know you're at the theater so much and don't watch a lot of TV. Do you guys watch any Netflix?
No, I'm not a member because, yeah, I am at the theater so much.
Yeah,
Michael?
No.
Yeah, because Netflix is now streaming Memphis.
Memphis, yeah.
And I thought that was very interesting. See how that does and see if this is going to open up
new
options for folks to see shows and say, hey, this was so good, I want to go see this in New York, or when it's touring in my local production, if a national tour comes around or somebody does it locally, that'd be great.
Do we know if that's a first? Did they do it for Rent, maybe? Or
well, this is Netflix streaming.
Yes. Oh, okay.
So, I mean, you can get Rent on the five different versions of Rent on DVD. You can get them through Netflix, and
okay.
I've gotten some of them before and watched them over and over and over and over and over and over and over. So, I'm kidding. But I actually, you know, they did one of the Rent DVDs. I think it was the first one that they did. They did a documentary about the folks on the line for Rent, the rent heads or whatever they called themselves. And they did a documentary that was actually really interesting. And I encourage anybody to check that out if you have Netflix or you have the Rent DVD or a friend with a Rent DVD. You can see that it was an interesting documentary. We're going to wrap up with a discussion about how rude should theater critics be, a story that Michael Billington wrote in The Guardian this week. But before we do that, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo. Right below the logo, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time there's a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to your iTunes, and you can listen to it through many of your iTunes-related devices. But if you don't like iTunes, you can listen to it on the Zune Marketplace. You can listen to it through Google's Listen application. You can listen to it on a BlackBerry or an iPod or iPhone or whatever through an application called Stitcher, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R. And you can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. You can also get in touch with all of us, Peter, Michael, me, anybody else. Whose contact information through going to BroadwayRadio.com, and all our contact information will be on the page there. So Michael Billington at The Guardian wrote a story about how rude should theater critics be because a theater critic at The Telegraph is being sued over a book review. And so I wonder if this, we wonder if this can translate to a theater reviewer. Now, neither Michael nor Peter has a reputation for being particularly sharp-tongued, but certainly others
James,
have been.
James, you could fill Madison Square Garden with my enemies. So no matter, it's impossible to be in this job any length of time and not make enemies. It's just impossible.
Agreed.
Yeah, so that's part of it.
So what do you think about,
Well, I don't know the details, but you would have to say, you'd have to say something personally libelous. You'd have to say, you know, this person slept with the producer to get the part.
Right.
In order to do you know any details without getting like really into it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the question becomes: did this book reviewer buy the book and review it? Was he sent the book? I guess that might even make a difference legally, because if you are sent the material, or we're invited to these shows, we are therefore given license to say what we feel. If we're invited, maybe buying a ticket is a different circumstance. Again, I don't know law, but I mean, that's what occurs to me right off the top of my head.
Hey, did you see the article in the New York Times from Lucky, from the Creptacular?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And she kind of touched on this about, you know, don't tell me what I can and can't write. You know, she bought a ticket for some, you know, Lucky and the Mick and the Creptacular is a pretty new website. So they don't get comped. So they buy all their tickets for shows that they see, and they bought a ticket for something if I'm remembering correctly, it was up at SUNY Purchase or something, and there was an announcement before the show asking everybody, not just them, not to blog it. So,
That's like, you know, good luck, folks. I mean, that's like closing the door, not only after the horse is left, yeah, but after the whole, you know, it's not going to happen. I mean, they can ask for it as a courtesy if they feel, for whatever reason, if they're still working on the show or what, I mean, it's a public performance, and anyone is entitled to do that.
Wow, as if those pre-show announcements aren't long enough now to add, you know, and please don't blog about it, another thing. Wow, we're never going to see the show.
Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, what the role of the reviewer is getting, it seems in the last couple of years, has been challenged more and more.
Yes.
From the producer side and from, you know, the audience side, and a lot of different, you know, bloggers and Twitterers and things like that have come into this to make everybody a reviewer of some sort. So I guess this is going to be very interesting to see, you know, how this all shakes out. Peter, has this been an ongoing thing for many years, and it's just that I've not been paying attention?
No. It's definitely reached ahead. But it's funny. I was thinking of something yesterday while listening to the news and hearing about how many baseball players were traded yesterday, because July 31st is the trading deadline. Yeah. If you don't trade players by July 31st, they have to stay with the team for the rest of the year. It's just considered too terrible to make somebody leave a team for just a couple of months, you know, and uproot the family and all that kind of stuff. So if you're going to hear about trades, and we heard about quite a few of them yesterday. Now, the thing is, there was a time when any baseball player could be traded. That's no longer the case. If you've been in for a certain number of years, it's sort of like you have a type of tenure. You can't be traded. And this all happened back in the 60s when a ball player named Curt Flood said, you know, you just can't trade me from one team to the other. What am I, a slave? I mean, this is ridiculous. And he really took his case to the Supreme Court and won the case. And that's why all this changed. So while this may seem like a far afield analogy, the point is that when I was growing up, trading in baseball was just an accepted thing. We just assumed that for time immemorial it was going to happen. But now that there's a lawsuit against a critic, who knows what this may open up. It may very well be something that, just as the Curt Flood incident changed things profoundly, who knows, maybe this lawsuit will change things profoundly, and maybe we'll all have to watch our steps and be far more polite. I mean, I don't know. I don't know.
I'm sorry, though. I missed the first part of what you said. What specifically is the target of the lawsuit? What specifically happened?
In Michael Billington's article, you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll read the first paragraph. It says, okay. I was out of the country last week, and I've only just caught up with the legal action brought by Sarah Thornton against The Telegraph over a book review Lynn Barber said to contain malicious falsehood. Since Thornton was awarded damages, some people seem to think that criticism has had its wings clipped. Actually, I had thought not. The judge was careful to say in summing up that a reviewer is entitled to be spiteful as long as she is honest.
Yeah, oh, well, okay. That was, so that's what I was alluding to. I mean, if there are factual inaccuracies that are in some way, you know, libelous and negative, then that's the only – that could be grounds for a lawsuit, but
sure,
that doesn't usually happen in a review. I mean, it those kind of things wouldn't even really come up. I mean, if you said, you know, so and so never, you know, would never have won, could never win an award, you know, if they live to be 100 and they've already won 2 Tony Awards. I don't know, you know, I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah.
John Q. Smith, whose play opened the other night, and I hear he's a pedophile, you know, that might be a problematic thing. So you wouldn't want to write that or have that out there. But yeah, Barry is being challenged can work either way. You know, so this may be very if somebody else decides to try it, it may be a very expensive and frivolous lawsuit. Could be.
I want to correct myself. In Lucky's article in the New York Times, it was a subscription series at Vassar College. She went to go see the Duncan Sheik's Stephen Sedder musical, The Nightingale. It was at Vassar College, and they were told, let's see. Well, she also talked about Spider-Man and how, mm-hmm. you know, she paid for her tickets at Spider-Man, and while they were in previews, she felt that since she had paid for them, she had the right to talk about them. But I'll link to this article in the show notes, and you can, you know, get in touch with us and let us know what your thoughts are on these things that we've talked about. So I guess we'll wrap it up here. Anything mm-hmm. else you guys want to add?
Mm-mm. I'm fine.
Michael?
Just quickly, I saw, I haven't seen much lately, but I did see All New People, the play by Zach Braff at Second Stage, and I thought it was very, very enjoyable. If you want an evening of laughs with a really excellent cast, Justin Bartha, Kristen Ritter, David Wilson Barnes, and Anna Camp, go see the play. It's Justin Bartha, you know, I'm not sure exactly how much stage experience he has overall, but he only made his Broadway debut last season in Lend Me a Tenor, or 2 seasons ago, whenever that was. But he seems so natural on stage. I hope he does more shows.
I think that I do have it on the schedule for us to talk about All New People next week, because I wanted to have Peter see it first.
Yeah, and
I also might see it this week. I'm trying to schedule my kids and tennis and swimming and all other stuff that we ski. But yeah, no, I want to talk about that because this, if anything, Zach Braff knows how to get press. Like, I mean, he's everywhere. People are talking about All New People right now. Let's talk about it next week.
Okay. Ready? Yeah.
Okay. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, or as I should say, Michael Anthony Portantier and Peter Joseph Felicia, this is James Vincent Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Have a great week.
It sounds silly, but I wish I never had let the moment slip by. Oh, what a sin, what an awful, awful shame. I would feel so much better if there was someone to blame. I know that's the way it goes, it's part of the game to let the moment slip by. Again, I don't. Let the moment slip by. The moment.